Well, good morning to you. My name is Ian Spence, and I'm also one of the pastors here at Graceful. And this morning we're going to be looking at this passage just read to us. We're doing a series on the epistles to the Thessalonians, and we're on the second epistle, and we're looking at chapter 2. When I was studying in the UK, we suddenly had these posters appearing around the place with this picture of a young boy with a chubby face, arms outstretched, with the words written underneath, "Come to me, all you who labor and are heavy laden, and I will give you rest." Obviously an imitation of Jesus. He was an 80-year-old guru of the Divine Light Mission. And what I found particularly scary was the fact that university students, a number of them, were being taken in by this scam. And what I take from that is that when it comes to spiritual matters, people can easily be duped. And this is the fear, I think, that Paul has for these Thessalonians, that they will be easily led astray. As we come to the passage, though, one of the problems that we face is that there's a lot of information that the Thessalonians obviously have. Paul has spoken to them at length about some of the issues that he now speaks about, information that we don't have access to. And that does create one or two problems for us. You get a sense of this from verse 5. Have a look at verse 5 down in your passages. "Don't you remember that when I was with you, I used to tell you these things?" In other words, I told you about the final rebellion. We spoke about that. I also told you about this man of lawlessness when I was with you. Don't you remember this? Have you forgotten so quickly? Is the impression that I get from that particular verse. Which may explain for us why the information that Paul has given us here in the passage is quite scanty, really. There's a lot of gaps. And it's because he's just summarizing. He's just giving a summary of the facts that he's already spoken to these Thessalonians at great length about on a previous occasion. So it does make it a little bit more difficult to actually get to the bottom of what Paul is actually speaking about in this particular chapter. Turning to the passage itself, it's obvious that Paul is concerned, that he is worried that these Thessalonians might be disturbed or hijacked in their faith. He's received reports, and it seems that he says, I'm a little bit concerned that you guys are going to be led astray by false teachers. These false teachers were claiming that Jesus had in some sense already come, that the second coming had already happened. You can see that in verses 2 and 3. "Don't let yourself be unsettled or alarmed by any teaching that asserts that the day of the Lord has come already or has already come. Don't let anyone deceive you about these things." So you've got to ask the question, well, what was actually happening? How was this deception working itself out? Had these Thessalonians, for example, heard rumors about the fact that somewhere Jesus had arrived, that he had come, that he was here now? Were they worried maybe that they were going to be left behind, that he'd forget about them? Maybe they were asking, well, you know, maybe we should look into these things because who knows? Maybe it is Jesus after all. So let me ask you, if you heard that Jesus had arrived in some remote part of the world, that he was here, would you consider that to be a possibility? Would you say to yourself, well, maybe it is, who knows? Would you feel that you had a responsibility at least to check it out? Would you? It's a question. Would you? I hope your answer to that question would be a categorical no. No ways. Because we've already learned over the previous weeks that when Jesus does return, there will be no mistake. It'll be absolutely clear. We'll be left in no doubt that he has actually come. As we've already seen, his coming will be a public event. Every eye will see it. It'll also be personal. the Lord Jesus himself will come down from heaven with a loud command, with the voice of the archangel, and with the trumpet call of God. And we saw last week, it will be powerful, even spectacular. Jesus will be revealed from heaven in blazing fire with his powerful angels. So it's out of the question that Jesus suddenly arrives and we don't all know about it. It's a little bit of a wonder, and we're wondering if it's actually true. We will know when it happens. We'll be left in no doubt. But what Paul does for us in our passage now is he gives us another bit of information as to how we know whether or not it has actually happened, whether Jesus has actually arrived. And what Paul is actually saying here is that it must, first of all, I'm taking this off, guys, sorry. I think my head's too big for this thing. Paul offering another bit of information as to how we know whether it's actually happened. It can't possibly happen until certain things have first of all taken place, have preceded it. It must first of all be preceded, we're told by Paul in this passage, by some really bad sort of evil stuff that's going to happen, what he refers to as the rebellion. And then that will be followed by the, or at the same time or concurrent with the arrival of this imposter, the one that Paul refers to as the man of lawlessness. And you can see that, I think, in verse 3. That day will not come until the rebellion occurs and the man of lawlessness is revealed, the man doomed to destruction. Now, even though the information available to us is limited, we do know something about what this rebellious individual will look like, what he will be like. We know, for example, that he will be synonymous with lawlessness, as his name suggests. What we understand by that is that he will be opposed to all moral law. There are no moral absolutes. There is no right and wrong, according to this individual, in terms of the religion that he teaches. If it works for you, that's fine. Go for it. Who are we to judge? At the same time, he'll be opposed to all civil law. He will be the lawless one, encouraging anarchy, casting aside all restraint. So he'll be opposed to law, but he will also be opposed to God, we're told in this passage. Verse 4. He will exalt himself over above God. He will demand that he be worshipped instead of God. So this wicked individual, this evil imposter, will be lawless and godless. But who is he? Who is this lawless one? Well, he sounds a lot like the one that 1 John speaks about, the Antichrist. The one who will imitate Christ but will actually work against Christ. And you can see something of that here in this passage. He's an imitator of Jesus. He will appear like Jesus. He will be revealed, we're told, like Jesus was revealed. Remember the pulling back of the veil? There's a similarity here in that term that Paul uses for him. And then his actual arrival will be referred to as a parousia, same word that is used for Jesus. So clearly the idea of this person being an imitator of Christ is present in our passage. One of the insights that John brings to us from his epistle is that although the Antichrist is coming, he's on his way, yet already there are many Antichrists who've actually gone out into the world, what you could call a small Antichrist or little Antichrist or people who share the same sort of ideas and intentions. That's what 1 John speaks about. And Paul expresses the same sort of idea here in verse 7, where he says that the secret power of lawlessness is already at work. It's already happening. So I think you've got parallels there. Now, I've got no doubt that you can suggest various examples of these forerunners of this great pretender. People who have gone out ahead of him. People like, for example, Antiochus Epiphanes, second century, basically set up his own altar in the temple and then had a pig sacrificed upon it. The ultimate sacrilege for any God-fearing Jew. Or maybe one of the Roman emperors like Nero, who mercilessly persecuted and killed Christians, throwing families and children and women to the lion. Or maybe Muhammad. And his religion has done so much damage to the church. So many people have suffered as a result of it. Or maybe various immoral popes could also be aligned with the Antichrist. Maybe you think of Hitler or Stalin. Maybe ISIS, more recently, would be examples of these little lawless fellows who've gone out, with the main one still to come. The image of the lawless one, I think, also conveys an image of maybe in terms of a metaphor, an image of what we find in our own culture these days. For example, secularism, which sees Christianity as the ultimate evil, attacks all expressions, all notions of morality, glorying in wickedness and discouraging and disparaging righteousness. You only have to think of the way that our society mutilates our unborn, encourages marital unfaithfulness, entertains every form of sexual perversion. So I'm sure you can think of your own examples. It's interesting that Paul is referring to this period of lawlessness in verse 3, uses a word which carries the idea also of apostasy, revolt against God. So it seems that this lawlessness will also invade the church. That's implied, I think. And the church will be caught up in this revolt against God and his authority. For example, the denial of Christ's deity. I don't know if you realize this, but when I was at studying in theology, we were at a college in the UK, and one of our lecturers was actually a participant in a book, who had contributed towards a book called The Myth of God Incarnate. In other words, that it's a myth that Jesus was actually divine, and he was an ordained clergyman. But we find examples of that even abounding around us. Denying the deity of Christ, abandoning biblical standards of morality. It almost seems like anything goes these days in terms of the church. And we've got far too many examples of this happening all around us in so-called churches. All of these antichrists are forerunners of the antichrist, or as Paul expresses it here, the lawless one, the man of lawlessness who is coming. But Paul seems to be saying that the sign that the return of Christ is close, is imminent, will be the outbreak of evil like never before. When God, as it were, lets go of the leash. The picture I have here in terms of this verse, and we're looking down at the passage where he speaks about restraint will be removed. The picture I have here is of a Rottweiler, ferocious, teeth flashing, growling, lunging. But as long as it's held on the leash, it can't do that much damage. But as soon as you let go, that's when all hell breaks loose. Evil is being restrained for the moment, seems to be what Paul is saying. But a day is coming when the leash will be released, when civil authority is set aside, when anarchy prevails, when everyone will do what is right in his own eyes. Paul speaks in verse 11, it's a similar vein of God sending a delusion upon people because they refuse to believe the truth, but choose instead to embrace the devil's lies. You can see that in verse 11. The idea here, I think, is that a time comes when God says, no, enough is enough. If you persist in your silly ideas and you're following these different myths, if you will not listen, if you continue with your new age stuff, you're dancing with the moonies, if you're open to every new guru, you persist with your silliness, then a time is coming when I will hand you over to all of it. I will let you have complete freedom to pursue the things you're pursuing. I'll hand you over to your folly until it makes you crazy and weird. When you see evil ratcheted up like this, Paul seems to be saying, well, then the rebellion is upon us. And then you will know the time for the lawless one has come. And now here's the thing to notice. This coming will be with great power and with signs and wonders. And I think that explains his ability to deceive, because we as people love the idea of the supernatural. We're intoxicated. We're attracted to the idea of the display of power. People love operating in that sort of realm. Can he heal? Can he perform miracles? Can he heal my mother of her cancer? Can he make my crippled husband walk? Can he make me feel warm and fuzzy inside? Well, then he must be the real deal. Well, guess what? The lawless one can mimic all of that sort of stuff. He can copy many of the miracles that we see around us, because the source of his power, we're told, is Satan himself. He is Satan's tool. By means of these signs and wonders, he'll be able to draw people, the unsuspecting, into his web. I've got a bit of an aside here, something that it is an aside, but it's an interesting one, because you've all heard of dispensationalists. You've all heard of premillennialists. You may have read the series called the Left Behind series. That's part of that dispensational perspective, if you like. And what they find in this passage is evidence for their idea that Jesus is going to come secretly and whisk away Christians in what is referred to as the secret rapture, leaving behind the others to face the next 7 years of tribulation. That's part of the teaching of the dispensationalists. They sort of feel that you have an idea here of the church being whisked away when it speaks about the restraint being removed. I heard of a bumper sticker that read something like this: if the rapture has happened, then this car has no driver. And the impression is that the driver was whisked away and the car's just carrying on driving. I just want to say, there is no hint in this passage of any secret rapture of Christians. And what's more, Jesus' return, as we've already heard, will be public. It will be a demonstration that's visible to all and is, in terms of its extent, is spectacular. And the rebellion will precede his coming, not follow it. So time to bin those left behind books that you might have in your library. It's a bit of an aside, back to the passage. To summarize our passage, we're living at present in this period of restraint in which the forces of lawlessness are being held back to some extent. Then secondly, this period will be followed by another period, a period of lawlessness, when there's an outbreak of apostasy and anarchy and immorality. It'll also be a period where there will be a rise to fame of the satanically inspired individual who will be credited with some pretty amazing things, signs and wonders. He will promote a religion of pleasure-seeking hedonism in which anything goes, whatever makes you happy. And he will set himself up as God's rival to be worshipped and served by his adoring followers. And then, only then, will Jesus return. And you can see that, I think, in verse 8. And what he will do is he will overthrow this scoundrel, this man, this one of lawlessness. He will overthrow him with the breath of his mouth, verse 8. And what I picture when I hear those words is I picture somebody blowing out a candle And it'll be that easy for Jesus to snuff out this great deceiver. Furthermore, he'll be destroyed, we're told, by the splendor of his coming. It's a little bit like when you go to a sewer and you open the lid and you see these cockroaches scurrying away into the darkness. Cannot bear the light. And it'll be the same here. He cannot bear the light of God's glory, of Jesus' glory. In closing, I want you to notice what is Paul's chief concern in this passage. His chief concern is not that the Thessalonians won't be able to endure the suffering, the hardship that will result from this period of rebellion, should it occur in their lifetime. That's not his concern, because he's already commended them on the fact that they have endured persecutions and sufferings. We saw that last week. So it's not that. He's not afraid that they won't be able to survive the difficult times. No, I think what he's really nervous about, what he's really afraid of, is that they will be led astray. He pleads with them, verse 3, don't let anyone deceive you in any way. And again in verse 15, so then, brothers and sisters, stand firm. Hold fast to the teachings we passed on to you, whether by word of mouth or by letter. So that question that really you need to be asking yourself is, how do we resist being led astray? How do we safeguard ourselves against that ever-present danger? How do we do that? Well, I want to give you just three things. Three ideas in closing, three suggestions. First of all, do not let yourself be persuaded by demonstrations of supernatural power. Remember, the devil is able to mimic all of these sorts of things, healings and miracles. He's the master of deception, and he will do whatever it takes to draw you in. I've met so many people who basically argue their case on the basis of what they have seen or what they've experienced, and you're not allowed to call it into question. That is so silly. The thing you should not be allowed to call into question is the word, is God's truth. That's where our authority lies. Don't be deceived by experiences or by demonstrations of power that you may have witnessed. Then secondly, and from the passage, hold fast to the teachings passed on to you in the Bible. And in this regard, it's really important that you learn to read Scripture in context. Verses within paragraphs, paragraphs within chapters, chapters within the Bible. Be very suspicious of people like myself or anyone else in a position of leadership who pulls verses from 100 different places, threads them together so that they can make them say what they want them to say. That's a recipe for disaster. Learn to read the Bible in context. Read what's before. Try and understand where it's heading. Read what's afterwards. Try and understand the flow. Only then are you in a position where you can begin to understand the particular verse or verses in question. Listen again to Paul's words of caution in verse 15. So then, brothers and sisters, stand firm and hold fast to the teachings we passed on to you, whether by word of mouth or by letter. Stand fast on the teachings that we gave you. And then thirdly and lastly, love the truth, verse 10. In particular, the truth about Jesus, about the good news about Jesus, dying on the cross for us, bearing our sin to the cross, and dying in our place. Love the truth. Glory in the grace of God that has saved you. Glory in God's undeserved favor. Reflect on it often. Meditate on it. Savor it in your heart. Love. Love, love the truth. Amen.